when you're dealing with tough issues, especially involved with mental health, if you don't laugh, you're never going to make it through.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the show. Our guest today is Matthew Quick, New York Times bestselling author of many novels, including The Silver Linings Playbook, which was made into an Oscar-winning film. His work has been translated into 30 languages, and I'm sure this interview will be as well. Matthew, or Q as he is often called, has a new novel called The Good Luck of Right Now. Eric, let's hear the interview.
Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So our podcast is based on the parable of two wolves, in which there is a grandfather who's talking with his grandson, and he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf who represents things like kindness and love and joy, and the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like hatred and greed and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks and he says, Grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by just asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in your work.
I feel like I could talk about that for hours. It's one that I've heard before and I've thought about deeply. I'm somebody who has struggled with anxiety and depression for pretty much my entire life. But I only began talking openly about that when I started to publish for the first time, and largely because I was writing about those things. So I had to kind of come out, if you will. I'm someone, you know, who writes fiction for a living, so I'm very interested in narrative and the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think that it's a perfect example. The parable of the wolf reminds us that we're constantly telling ourselves a story about who we are. I grew up in a working class neighborhood, and I was told at the age of 16, 17, 18 that, you know, a career in fiction writing was not necessarily for me because I didn't have the pedigree, because the people that raised me were not fiction writers. But that was a narrative that I didn't choose to believe. You know, I tried to feed the other narrative, and it was hard to believe that I could transcend the expectations of my community and do something that people were not doing at the time, which was writing fiction. But it took a while, and I kept feeding that and feeding that narrative. Now in my life, when I sit down to write fiction, every new novel is a leap of faith, and I find myself not only trying to monitor the story that I tell myself, but also monitor the stories that other people are telling me. I try to surround myself with people who make me feel that I can make good art. And the people who make me feel as though I can't are the people who feed the bad wolf. I try to keep away from those people, which is hard, but necessary if you want to do things that not everybody does and try to live an examined life.
Exactly. And you talk there about the stories that we tell ourselves. And in your books, one of the things I notice is that the characters tend to do, I don't know if the word I would use in some cases is pretending or telling themselves stories that allow them to carry on in the face of face of trouble.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm very interested in, not only as a storyteller, but also as a human being. I grew up in a very religious home. I was raised in a Methodist church. I no longer attend any church now. But, you know, story and religion and, you know, the tales and the myths that we embrace and we tell really do shape our lives. And so as a storyteller with my characters, I'm very interested in not only the myths and the stories that they inherit, but also the ones that they invent for themselves. And I find myself doing this both as a novelist and as a human being as well. The story and the narrative that I buy into evolves and it changes as you progress. When I was 16, I thought, you know, that I was a kid from a blue-collar neighborhood that would probably never get to be a novelist. That was a story that I was told. Now I'm, you know, a published novelist who obviously buys into a very different narrative. So it's evolved.
So your latest book is called The Good Luck of Right Now, and in a quick summary for the readers, it's a book about a main character named Bartholomew who is a little bit off, and he's lived his entire life with his mother. He's a grown man. I'm not sure how old he is. Maybe in his 40s and
late
30s,
yeah.
And his mother dies, and he's sort of confronted with what does he do with his life now. And the framework that you set the book up in is he is writing letters to Richard Gere, who was his mother's favorite actor. And he actually believes at points that Richard Gere is inspiring him and helping him. And that's sort of the pretending that goes on. One of the things that the title of the book, The Good Luck of Right Now, is based on a philosophy that Bartholomew's mother had. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's really about balance. She comes up with this idea that when things happen to them that are tragic or bad, that they should believe that other good things are happening to other people around the world simultaneously to equal it out. And so she almost celebrates when something bad or tragic happened to them, because she believes that in order for there to be balance, something good must be happening elsewhere, and vice versa. When something good happens to them, she feels a little bit of shame, or she worries that something bad is happening to someone else. And the concept of balance is something that I had been thinking a lot about, because I was in the process of transitioning from a relatively unknown writer to a writer who was succeeding beyond most people's expectations. And during the time of this Silver Linings Playbook being adapted into a film, I was going through this phase where I was accomplishing things that many of my mentors had not accomplished. And I realized that, you know, the Oscars is a perfect example. You know, only certain movies get selected and only certain people win. And that means that other people aren't selected and other people will lose. And only certain books get adapted into films. And that means that others will not. And so this whole idea of, you know, balancing, you know, the lack of success I had in my life for a long time with this sudden success that I was being confronted with made me think deeply about these things. And, you know, for Bartholomew's mother, it's really also a survival mechanism as well. Like, she's someone who is constantly experiencing tragedy and negativity and a lot of bad things. And so in order for her to cope, in order for her to get her son through these really difficult situations, she comes up with this philosophy that they can both embrace in order to deal with, you know, some of the horrific things that are going on in their lives. And a couple times throughout the narrative, Bartholomew muses that it might not even matter if it's true or not, but the story helps.
That gets back to the idea of that, to some degree, we are telling ourselves stories really about anything. I mean, most of the narrative that goes on in my head and most people I know is a version of some story, and about being conscious about choosing a story that actually serves us well, versus plenty of stories that don't serve us well. And I'll use that to transition into Bartholomew has a he calls it the angry little man in his stomach. who, when something is happening, the angry little man tends to do two things. One is he yells at him like, moron, retard, miserable failure. And at the same time, you have many different ways of describing how he's kicking his internal organs or digging his, you know, his claws into his stomach. And when I was reading that, I was thinking a little bit about, that sounds like a perfect description of the bad wolf for some of us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had a powerful realization in my 20s where I finally realized that my thoughts could make me physically ill to the point where it was completely debilitating. You know, the things that I was thinking about could make me feel nauseous or, you know, keep me from being able to perform or, you know, send me into a panic attack just because I was having certain thoughts. And it's really powerful to think that, you know, the narrative in our head can literally affect our, not only our mental health, but also our physical health as well, you know, just by the thoughts that we're thinking. It's a really, really powerful concept, you know. And so to get back to the idea of the bad wolf inside of us, you know, Bartholomew, my character, it could very easily be synonymous, you know, the angry man or the bad wolf. It's this thing that's constantly telling him that he's not good enough. It's affecting his mental health. It's affecting his physical health. And he realizes that it's the force or the narrative that he has to overcome, that he has to beat, that he has to, in some ways, appease as well. And he does battle daily with it.
Yeah, there's a part in the book where you talk about synchronicity. So one of the things that Bartholomew is wrestling with is the idea of synchronicity, also called unus mundus, which is based on a theory that Jung had. Can you expound upon that one?
You know, the idea that Bartholomew latches onto is this idea that things happen, you know, two events can be related not by their cause, but by their meaning to a certain individual, which of course is what Jung proposed. And so Bartholomew becomes obsessed for looking for these bits of synchronicity, almost as if to like breadcrumbs to lead him to something. And of course, the first bit that he finds is this letter from Richard Gere at this time when he needs a mentor. And so, you know, he kind of grafts a narrative onto that. And so, you know, for me, you know, again, it gets back to the stories that we tell ourselves. And I do believe that there are rhythms to the universe. You know, there are patterns that emerge often in hindsight. And I often think about stories. And when I was in the MFA program, one of my advisors, Paul Selleck, he said that, you know, a story should make sense in retrospect. So the reader should be going through and then you have that aha moment and you look back and you see all the signs that were leading to that inevitable conclusion. And I think in a lot of ways that's really what Bartholomew is trying to do. He's trying to see the signs as they're there, not in retrospect, and try to figure out his life. And I think to some extent we all do that, whether we buy into the concept of synchronicity or coincidence or signs. You know, we're all looking for, you know, the rhythm to our lives that give us meaning and help us make sense of all of these, you know, chaotic things that are happening to us. I think that's largely what I do as a fiction writer. You know, I think fiction writing is a form of therapy for me. I always say I take all of the chaos in my chest and my mind and I try to make order on the page. And I think that's exactly what my characters are doing as well.
Girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What? I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
We had a conversation a couple weeks ago with a woman who wrote a book about the self-help industry, and we were talking back and forth a little bit about the idea of positive thinking and when does that cross over into denial. And I think that's really interesting in what we're talking about, where you've got, whether it's in our own lives or characters' lives, where we're telling ourselves a story, and yet at some points that crosses over into not addressing or dealing with things that need to be dealt with. You have any thoughts on that?
I do. You know, it's a fine line. And, you know, I think that if you ask several different people where that line is, they're all going to tell you a different answer. Maybe I can answer best with an anecdote. When I was in the MFA program, I had quit a tenured teaching position, and I'd moved in with my in-laws to be a, you know, full-time fiction writer. And for, you know, 2.5 years, I was an unpaid fiction writer, not making any money, living with my in-laws. And, you know, many people in my family and my friends were convinced that I had made this huge mistake, that I was completely delusional, that I was irrational, and that at the age of 33, I shouldn't be, you know, sitting alone in a basement with fictional characters trying to pretend that I was some type of artist. They were convinced that I was wrong. And one day I went for a run and I was feeling completely dejected. You know, when you live in America and you're a man and you're 30 years old and you tell people that you are an artist and that you are a full-time fiction writer and you're not making any money, people make you feel as though you're committing a crime. And, you know, that's largely how the people in my life made me feel, that I was irresponsible, illogical, selfish, you know, in denial. And so I was on this run and I was really worried about my future. My bank account was at zero. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do next. I had kind of worn out my welcome with my in-laws, and I didn't want to live with them forever. And so while I was running, I was thinking about, you know, the possibility of giving up my dream of being a fiction writer. And I was running and running and running, and I looked up into the sky, and it was this gray winter day, and there was this beautiful cloud, and it was illuminated by the sun that was behind it. And so it was kind of, you know, there was a silver lining around it, and it was absolutely breathtakingly gorgeous, to the point where I thought to myself, maybe it's an omen or a sign that I'm going to make it as a fiction writer, that I should keep going. And immediately I started to yell at myself in my head. Maybe the bad wolf was speaking, so to speak. And, you know, that voice said, that's delusional, that's silly, that's magical thinking. Like, you can't believe that. You know, you can't believe that because you saw a beautiful, you know, cloud, you know, lined in silver, that means anything. You know, that's completely irrational. And then the good wolf stepped in and said, well, what if you allow yourself to believe it just so it gives you enough fuel to keep going? You know, you've been working every day. You know, you've been putting a lot of time and effort into this. Your stories are improving. You've been published in some small literary journals. There's a lot of positives here. You've been working towards an MFA. The good wolf stepped in and I started thinking about it. You know, what if I pretended that this sign meant something and it just gave me the fuel or the courage to keep fighting? And then I had a moment as I was running and I said, what if I had a character who believed that? And that's where I got the idea for Pat Peoples and the Silver Linings Playbook. And I went home that night and I started writing. And, you know, nobody was paying attention at that time, but the good wolf was winning. And, you know, he was saying, you know, look, you know, this is something. You have an idea here. You've been working hard. You've been honing your talents. See this through. And I did. And I wrote a book called The Silver Linings Playbook. And, you know, it was published and it was made into a movie, and a few years later I was sitting at the Oscars. You know, that was born at a moment where if I had told people, like, hey, I got this idea while I was running because I saw, you know, a silver lining in the sky, you know, people would have thought that was wildly irrational, but that's exactly what happened. And that led to a lot of good things for me. And so it's hard because when you talk about the arts, and you talk about pretending and you talk about, you know, positive thinking and what is dangerously, you know, irrational. You know, I think it's really hard to answer that because any artist before they're making money seems like they're doing something wildly irrational and silly. And, you know, society is always going to tell you that, you know, you're a dreamer, you know, that it's not worth doing until you make money, you know, and I think that that's a horrible way to qualify something, to give something validity. But unfortunately, in America, before you make money as a fiction writer and artist, you know, people are always going to tell you that you're delusional.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that, and I've been thinking a lot about this, where is that line? And one of the things that I've noticed is that there's a line, it seems to be, if people are really doing the work, really engaged in it, really going after it, that seems to me to be an indicator versus thinking about and pretending that we're going to be something without actually putting the effort in. And it's clear that you put that work in.
Yeah, and I think that is it's definitely true, whether we're talking about art or mental health or relationships. You know, you've got to do the work, you know, and I worked extremely hard on my fiction, and you know, I like to think that I work extremely hard on, you know, myself as well, my mental health, my relationships with people. But it's still a constant battle, you know, and I don't want to diminish the fact that I often, you know, felt as though the bad wolf, if you will, was winning a lot, and there were times that I got very close to quitting before Silver Linings took off. And you know, there have been times in life that I've come close to quitting, you know, on myself as well. And I would say that for most of my life, I've felt as though most people in society were feeling the bad wolf. And that's troublesome for me because, you know, to be an artist oftentimes means walking alone. It means flying in the face of convention. It means doing what other people think is irrational or silly, and you know, finding truths before others necessarily believe that they're true. It means believing wildly and doing things that oftentimes other people just don't get. And so it's a tough line to walk because you know, you always want to be rational as well. You don't ever want to slide into delusion.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about your work is it's both humorous and really touching and poignant at the same time. And I read somewhere that you said humor has saved you a million times. And I think the role of, I've said before, that levity is an unappreciated virtue. Can you tell us more about the role of humor in feeding your good wolf?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I often tell a story about the first year I was working out of college. I worked with teenagers diagnosed with severe autism in a classroom, doing job training and behavior therapy. And these were kids that were often violent, nonverbal, When we took him to the Pizza Hut, we could clear out the Pizza Hut in about 5 minutes. You know, they're great kids and I love them. And one of the things that happened was the turnover was quite high because the pay was low and the work was really hard. And so we'd get new faculty in all the time. And on the first day when we had a new person working with our kids, we'd always watch to see if they would laugh. Not laugh at the kids, but at the absurdity of some of the situations that we were in. Laugh in a good way with everybody. And if they laughed, we knew that they would come back the next day. If they didn't laugh once throughout the day, we would never see them again. And, you know, it was at that point that I realized that when you're dealing with, you know, tough issues, especially involved with mental health, that if you don't laugh, you're never going to make it through. And, you know, for me, I tell stories that are often, you know, tragic and difficult, and I try to shine a light on things that, you know, society doesn't always necessarily want to look at. And so I think the humor is a really great tool for letting people know that it's okay to have human feelings, to feel as though, you know, things are absurd at times, but it's still okay. Like, we can still laugh and we can get through this. And so when I'm writing, I know when I start to laugh, you know, through the writing of the manuscript, laugh with my characters, laugh at the absurdity of their situations, that I'm going to finish the manuscript.
What were some of your favorite, without giving any plot away, what were some of your favorite funny moments in The Good Luck of Right Now?
It's hard to talk about the jokes without spoiling them for people. You know, I can think of very specific moments in the book, but again, I don't want to give spoilers. Max, I will say that the character of Max was a lot of fun to write. And I'm trying to speak without spoilers, but he was just so much fun to inhabit because he was just so uninhibited and he was so honest and in so many ways he was just so beautifully absurd. But through all of that, he was just really kind and, like, he really cared about people and he really cared about animals and, you know, just a very beautiful soul within him, but hilarious at the same time, you know, because he spoke his mind and he would say the things that he wanted to say. So again, I'm talking in a vague way, just to not to give spoilers.
Yeah, I actually didn't read the book. I listened to it, a version of it on a book on tape, and the guy who did Max did a great Max. I mean, I was laughing the whole time. I'd agree too. I think he was definitely the one that I got the most laughs out of. But there's a lot of humor.
You know, it's funny because people have wildly different reactions to my books. I remember with Silver Linings, one of the first big public moments was that I received an honorable mention for the Penn Hemingway Award. You know, I got to meet Hemingway's son. It was this very swanky affair in Boston. And I remember speaking with a very famous author and who had read the book, and he said to me, "Your book is hilarious. You know, Silver Linings Playbook was so funny. I laughed all the way through it. I just couldn't stop laughing." And then I turned around and there was another person associated with Penn Hemingway, and they said to me, "You know, I love Silver Linings, but it was just so sad. Like, I cried all the way through it." And it was literally, I just, you know, within 30 seconds, you know, complete opposite reaction to the book from two people who claim to love it. And I often think that our response to life, but particularly issues about mental health, really are telling, you know, about our attitudes about it as well. And, you know, they say that, you know, somebody's response to a book says a lot more about them than the author. And I think that that's generally true. But I love it when I hear from people like yourself who laugh at my jokes, because it makes me feel less alone and it makes me feel a little bit more normal. So thank you.
Well, I got both. Right. I got both the laughter and the sadness, which I think you said, if you're not both laughing and crying while you're writing it at points, you don't feel like you have it. And I think that's the gift of certain authors, is the ability to combine those two things, because a funny book is one thing and a sad book is another thing. But one that hits both those things. One of my favorite writers is John Irving, and he does a really good job of that.
Well, thank you for that comparison. I appreciate that. You know, I think, you know, like, comedy is, in some ways, is very close to tragedy. You know, if we think about the things that we laugh at, you know, You know, for example, why do we laugh when, you know, somebody's in a movie and they trip and fall down? You know, if there's funny music behind it, why do we laugh when somebody falls? And I think it's because in many ways it's unexpected. We laugh at what we don't really understand or what we might be a little bit afraid of. And so I think it's interesting to see how those two, you know, comedy and tragedy are, you know, kind of yin and yang.
Speaking of fine lines, that line between sort of laughing at somebody and laughing with somebody, you know, if somebody falls down, it's funny. I always find the test to be, if I fall down, do I still think it's funny? Which I usually do. I usually think it's pretty funny. So
can we laugh at ourselves?
Exactly.
You know, I think that's it, you know. And I think that's really important. My wife is always saying to me, we should laugh more, and we laugh all the time. But I do think we should laugh more. You know, it's good medicine.
Girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've addressed the mental health and depression a lot. Are there any things you're willing to share in more detail about what that was like for you and how you've gotten through that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In Silver Linings Playbook, the movie, David wrote a line. It's not my line. It wasn't in the book. But Bradley Cooper talks about white-knuckling it. Like he says, I feel like I've been white-knuckling it for a long time. And when I was teaching in my 20s, I'm a very functional person who deals with depression, anxiety. I'm very good at putting on a mask. When I talk about my depression now from those days, my students will say, "There's no way, Q. Like you were so upbeat at school. Like you were the guy giving us the big speech before, you know, the soccer match or the basketball game. You're so positive in school." And you know, that was definitely one part of it, but I would come home exhausted and completely depleted. And, you know, I was privately dealing with a lot of anxiety. And, you know, of course, when you're hiding it all the time, it only makes it worse. And when you're not talking about it, it makes it worse as well. And I had somewhat of a breakdown in my late 20s. I was probably drinking too much at night. I was definitely drinking too much at night. I wasn't an alcoholic, but I was self-medicating, more than I probably should have been. And again, I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood. People didn't talk about mental health, you know. People weren't open about it. And what was worse was, the model for manhood that I received was, you know, you just keep your mouth shut and tough it out. You know, you bully your way through. And I tried to do that for a long time, but, you know, I realized that I had breaking points. And I also realized that I'm somebody who can appear to be an extrovert when I need to be, but my true nature is that of an introvert, and I need time alone. I need time to think. I need time to recharge my batteries. I don't like to make decisions quickly. And so, you know, picking the career choice of a high school English teacher, while I love doing that work, and I felt as though I was very good at it, was probably the worst career choice I could have made for my own mental health. Now writing fiction full-time, you know, when I had that mental breakdown, you know, in my late 30s, my wife kind of sat me down and said, you know, we can't go on like this. You've got to change. You know, I can't have you coming home, you know, depressed and anxious all the time. You've got to do something to help your mental health. And, you know, she gave me that talk, like, if you could do anything in the world, what would you do? You know, if you could get up tomorrow and do anything, what would make you happy? And I said, I would write fiction. And she said, well, you should. And I said, well, I can't, because we have a mortgage and I have tenure and, you know, we have health insurance. And, you know, I give a talk about this now, and I talk about how I used to polish the bars of my prison. You know, tenure was a bar. You know, it's a good thing to have tenure, but it was also, you know, it kept me trapped in the cage. And, you know, health insurance and a pension and, you know, having a house and, you know, all of these things that you're supposed to want made me feel incredibly trapped. And my wife and I got to this point where we just realized that we weren't living the lives that we had imagined. You know, we met when she was 17, I was 19, and we wanted to make art. We wanted to write. You know, that's what we wanted to do. And somehow we woke up 10 years later, you know, being these people that we really did not want to be, lives that we had not imagined for ourselves. And so my wife, you know, it's the credit goes to her. You know, she said, we can do this. We can change. And we took a road trip in Ireland where I was reading a lot of books on Buddhism. And, you know, for me at the time, that was a step out of my comfort zone. Again, being raised like very Protestant, you know, like exploring other views of the world. And we were drinking in Irish pubs and, you know, we were walking through this gorgeous countryside during the day. And my wife said to me, she's like, you're happy. Like, you're so happy on this trip. Like, wouldn't you like to be happy all the time? You know? And I really thought that that was an impossibility, that I couldn't do the things that I wanted to do, that, you know, that was for other people. But my wife, she just kept saying, you know, if you want to do this, you should do it. And she really kind of gave me the ultimatum of, you know, either we're going to change our lives or, you know, we can't go on like this anymore. And so I did. And it wasn't easy. When I quit my tenured teaching position, I was terrified. My father is a very pragmatic banker. And, you know, telling him I wanted to write fiction full time and leaving a steady paycheck just did not compute. And he's a huge fan now. Like, he gives my work to all of his customers and he's always coming out to my events and he's been really supportive. But at first, he called me an idiot. You know, he was furious. You know, he said he wasn't going to pay for my health insurance. He would not pay for my dental. What was I going to do in 3 years when I found out I wasn't a fiction writer and I was unemployable because I had this huge gap on my CV? You know, just really fear-based logic. And it worked because it scared the hell out of me. You know, but I always say, you know, people now, they'll say to me, you know, like, Q, you were so brave, like, leaving, you know, your tenured position and doing what you did, like, taking this giant leap of faith. And I always say I wasn't brave, you know, it was just a last-ditch effort to save myself. You know, I don't know that I would be here if I didn't do the things that I needed to do to feel mentally well. And so, you know, there was a lot of sacrifices, you know, living with my in-laws, and they're wonderful people, but it was very humbling to do that in my early 30s. You know, my best friend was in the process of, you know, building a very well-respected spinal implant company and experiencing wild success. And, you know, my friends were climbing the ladders of their jobs and buying bigger houses and having babies. And, you know, I felt very small, you know, as I sat typing away in a basement, you know, believing that I was going to be a fiction writer sometime. But, you know, again, like, there was that good wolf, and, you know, I kept trying to feed it and kept trying to believe that I could do the things that I wanted to do and were going to provide me with a better life. And now I write fiction full time, you know. So, you know, part of the year I travel and promote my books and I meet wonderful people, which is great. But for the other part of the year, I'm pretty much by myself with my wife. And You know, we live by the water now, and, you know, I get up when I want to, and I write fiction, and I can be alone, and I can take time to do things that make me feel healthy. You know, today my wife and I took an hour walk on the beach with the dog. You know, I worked hard too. You know, I did an interview, for people in the Philippines, and, you know, I worked on my fiction, but it's at my pace, and it's in an environment that makes me feel mentally well. I had to fight to get here. I had to fight really hard to get here, both, you know, in the arena of publishing, but also, you know, in my mind as well, to stop believing that I couldn't do all these things that I wanted to do, and really trusting that, you know, the feelings that I had and the belief that I needed to do what would give me the best life and make me feel most mentally well was right, and that I should trust my instincts, you know, which was really hard. You know, of course, after you go to the Oscars, everybody's on board, you know, and people come around, and it's nice to have that luxury now. But, you know, for a long time, I didn't have too many cheerleaders. And, you know, I think in some ways it's a rite of passage for every artist and maybe for every human being.
Yeah, that's a really great story. And that ended the way it did. And I think you may not have had a lot of cheerleaders, but it sounded like you had one of the most important ones, which is your wife. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah, I do. You know, I feel wildly blessed and very, very lucky to have my wife. You know, when people ask me, you know, a lot of people say, like, how do I become a fiction writer? You know, how do I become a published novelist? And one of the first things I'll say is make sure you choose the right life partner, you know, and I think that's probably true of, you know, whatever you want to do in life. But I often think about, you know, meeting Alicia when we were in our late teens and just how lucky, you know, we were to come across each other. There's a long story about that I'd sell on book tour, but, you know, I feel very grateful for that. But we've done the work too, I should say. You know, we work really hard to not only be the best people that we can be, but also we work hard on our relationship too.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up. Thanks very much for coming on the show. Like I said, I really enjoyed The Good Luck of Right Now. I'm looking forward to reading some of the other ones. Any idea? I know that The Good Luck of Right Now is in casting. Any idea when it might be a movie that people can see?
Well, I met with Dayton and Ferris, who directed Little Miss Sunshine about a month ago in LA, and they're very excited about the project, and there's all types of wonderful rumors and I'm not allowed to talk about right now, but we're hoping that they start filming relatively soon, so fingers crossed. I also have another book coming out next year called Love May Fail, which is also being made into a film as well.
Well, congratulations on all your success, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having us, and thanks for putting this good message out into the world. It's really important, and it's a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care, Matt.
Thanks,
Bye.
Matt.
You can learn more about Matthew Quick and this podcast in our show notes at oneufeed.net/Q.